to Leo to introduce the guest.
Hello, everyone. We are starting with our first interview, which is with William Briggs, a political economist who has experience of being involved as a teacher, journalist, and political activist, and has recently authored a book entitled China, the US, and Capitalism's Last Crusade. He's also a regular writer for Green Left and recently produced an article titled The US Role in the Russia-Ukraine Conflict, which will form the basis of our discussion. Good morning, William. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Leo. How are you?
Very well, thanks. I guess the first question is, what really has prompted the latest round of the Russia-Ukraine tensions? Because in the last sort of major iteration of it, I guess, around the annexation of Crimea and then the conflict in Donetsk, there was, I guess, a noticeable sort of build-up of tensions around the Euromaidan protests and then culminating in the removal of Yanukovych there. At least from my perspective, it seems that these tensions have sort of emerged out of nowhere. Is that your impression, and what do you see as the US role in this?
Yeah, right. Firstly, I think we need to go back a few years prior to the issues that you spoke of so correctly. United States foreign policy concerning the former Soviet Union, we need to go back to about 91, when Soviet Union still tentatively existed, and Bush Sr. and Gorbachev were trying to work out where the future would lie. But the consequence of that, there were a range of meetings, and Bush's then Secretary of State, James Baker, met with and ironed out some policy issues for the region. Chiefly among that was that, yes, NATO can have East Germany, if you like to put it as crudely as that. But in return, and it has been, it was established that, and I use your quote fairly accurately, not one inch eastward for NATO into either former Soviet republics or former allies of the Soviet Union. Now, that deal lasted about 3 years. And ever since then, there was a sort of almost like a salami slicing of the area. Country after country would be taken into NATO. And significant in that is Article 5 of the NATO doctrine, which says that if a NATO country is deemed to be under attack, then NATO will defend. Now, this is the background to what started happening in 2014 with Ukraine. So many countries had gone. Ukraine remained a relatively reasonable alliance with Russia until 2014, of course. And it's a policy that the United States had started a lot earlier, and Russia now appears to be acting very unconscionably by saying to a sovereign state, you cannot be part of NATO. But the deal was that it wouldn't be, and Russia feels itself, probably rightfully, totally encircled by hostile forces. And the Ukraine has played a significant role in that. Now, US foreign policy, of course, follows a number of transparent patterns, political, military, and chiefly economic, and we've seen over the years the political and the military areas of foreign policy in Europe being very successfully enacted, and now with the United States economy in fairly deep crisis, with $30 trillion worth of debt, there's an absolute reservoir of resources in Russia for exploitation. And I think that's really the background of the war. I don't think it came out of nowhere. I think it's been a long time coming.
And that guess brings us to, it's Jacob here, the kind of next kind of question, which is, I mean, I guess more commenting on Russia's sort of motivations, I guess, on all this. Like, do you think that, you know, Russia is attempting to assert itself as a hegemonic power in the East, given, you know, the whole context of China's replacement of the latter in that role in this kind of new kind of Cold War kind of scenario that we kind of face, you know, between, you know, the Western sort of nations and the United States on one end, and then, of course, you have countries like Russia and China. So I want to kind of hear some of your analysis on that.
Yeah, Russia certainly sees itself, whether you can use the term hegemon, I don't know, but it sees itself as a traditionally great power. And it has built its whole history on fairly extreme nationalism. And it maintains its sense of legitimacy at home by the nationalist sort of flag. We are great, we have been great, and we will be great. Not terribly different to the United States in this respect. It obviously, and Putin is fairly clear about this, he wants to restore the pride, if you like, of the former Soviet Union. That includes territory, if he could achieve it. Now, if possible, he would like to have Russian enclaves, at least in the Ukraine. If not that, if not reincorporation of Ukraine into the old empire, as it were. But at bottom line, he wants to see himself and his country as re-establishing pride. They were fairly harshly treated and done by after the Union collapse. Carpetbaggers just moved in, and it was a fairly humiliating time for them. And rightly or wrongly, that nationalism is reasserting itself. And that is one of the reasons, I think, why it's being met by such aggressive stance by the United States. Now, inevitably, clashes will occur when you have nationalisms bumping into each other. And Ukraine is being manipulated by the United States to become another serious nationalism in the region. Whether it's seeking hegemony, it's just it sees itself as a leading figure in that sphere of influence, and it's trying to reassert what it once had. I guess that's where I'm going.
Just following up on that question of nationalism, to what extent do you think Russophobia in the West has shaped some of the US response around this? I think in the past sort of decade, we've seen a resurgence of anti-Russian sentiment. There was the whole sort of Russia Gate campaign by the Democrats, essentially blaming Hillary Clinton's loss on a couple of $1,000s of Russian funding for some memes on Facebook. You know, it's like a pattern of fear of Russia. For example, when the Sputnik V vaccine came out, immediate sort of doubts about it. How do you think this has influenced, if at all, American foreign policy, at least sort of underlying?
Oh, yes. A little bit earlier I mentioned that Putin is playing very much to a domestic audience for legitimacy. Well, the United States play exactly the same role. And I can't remember the name of the author, but there was a fictional author many years ago who had one of his characters saying, hell, if we, what's the point of being an American if you can't have a Cold War? Their foreign policy has been designated around Cold War politics actually long before the Cold War started. It was an anti-Soviet thing from 1917 on, but it's an easy trigger to pull in the United States because they've had such a long, long history of being being anti-Russian, anti-Soviet. That has just been re-energized in the last period, partly because of the re-emergence of Russia under Putin as a strong, viable power, and partly because of the United States' global decline, particularly in relation to China. So the United States is attempting to do two things. It's attempting to politically maintain its unassailable role as leader of the world and to dig itself out of some fairly serious economic holes vis-a-vis its shrinking economic place in the world and, again, to capture market. So the anti-Russian thing was a really easy one for them to re-energise because it's been it's a bit like our anti-China sentiment in this country. It is so easy to scratch the surface and have it pop because we've been like that since the first fleet, if you like. We've been sort of fearful of China, the same way as the United States, totally unrealistically and necessarily have been fearful of Russia. It's just old knee-jerk reactions to issues that really were never there. But it is based in this idea of a weaker Russia means a stronger America.
Mm. And on that aspect of a weaker Russia, as you touched on earlier, one of the tools, I guess, used by the US and the West has been this cultivation of Ukrainian nationalism, which has seen quite sort of grotesque right-wing manifestations of it. What's your analysis on that and the potential dangers about a reawakened Ukrainian nationalism, which, you know, Russian nationalism is a force itself and, as you said, has quite negative aspects, but some of the sort of history of Ukrainian nationalism, especially sort of collaboration during World War II and the sort of Nazi aspect of it, what's your analysis of that whole situation?
Oh, yes, this becomes a really, really dangerous issue and one that can be manipulated, not necessarily even by Ukrainians themselves, but they, I think, are being manipulated from abroad through the US. But inside the Ukraine, as you so rightly pointed out, then have this long history of fairly extreme nationalist sentiment. The position during the war, as you say, with the collaboration with the Nazis, the guerrilla campaigns that were being waged against the Soviets. It's an interesting thing because they also had a long history of fairly close collaboration. I mean, the whole concept of Russia goes back to Kiev Rus. I mean, there's an undeniable link between them. Although politics in this era have been sadly motivated by the nationalist trigger, and that's what we're seeing in the Ukraine today. And it's when we see television reports of kids being drilled and all the rest of it, it's a very scary thing because truth gets jettisoned very quickly in all of this, and the flag waving, the tub thumping, is so easily manipulated, particularly with young people who don't really understand or experience a lot of things, even in this country. I mean, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, concepts of Anzac Day and all these sort of things were really, it slipped away into nothing in this country. And within the space of two governments, there's not a kid in a school in this country who won't be able to tell you with hand on heart that our troops went off to Gallipoli to protect and save our future. Now, if we can do it here, then how much more simple is it when you can be told that the enemy is just 20 kilometres down the road? So, yes, the nationalist thing, I think, as you pointed out, is a real danger in the Ukraine because the fascist elements were so central to their achieving the sort of government that they've got now.
Hmm. And because you wrote a quite an interesting article as well on the whole question around Taiwan and I guess the United States kind of policy. And I think you've given a very good kind of background and I guess an overview of a lot of the kind of different elements that are kind of driving, you know, the whole Russian-Ukraine kind of conflict. And of course, but then also talk about, you've also really raised a lot of quite great points around the US's, United States kind of whole role in this as well. And I guess I want to sort of take a question. I want to sort of ask this question, and this can be a bit of a concluding kind of question that we're going to, with some opportunity for some final comments as well. I want to kind of hear, what is your sort of take and your understanding, your kind of analysis of what are some of the similarities between, you know, the United States kind of policy towards Ukraine, but and also their policy towards the question of Taiwan and China? Because I think in some cases there's actually certain parallels to the situation, especially with, you know, how there's this, obviously this big push to get Ukraine into NATO, which obviously is all about kind of, in a certain sense, is motivated entirely by the imperialist kind of interests of the United States and also keeping Russia in line, so to speak.
Yes, you're dead right, the parallels are there. It's a fairly... US policy is to give them their credit for something, at least transparent. They make no bones about what they're all about. With Taiwan, and again, it's nothing happens of itself or out of a vacuum. When the pivot to Asia began, that was followed by the dredging of the islands. It was a response to a perceived threat on China's part. The United States have now continued the ringing of China with nuclear armed or potential weaponry. That includes positioning on Taiwan barrages for missiles that are 3 or 4 minutes flying time to Beijing. Now, not surprisingly, China sees that as a fairly worrying concept. China, rightly or wrongly, see Taiwan as Chinese territory. The Americans in the 70s, when they de-recognized Taiwan and recognized China as the legitimate sovereign Chinese entity, kept an ambiguous clause in their policy with Taiwan that if Taiwan were threatened, we would support Taiwan militarily if necessary. Now, it's almost as if they are making sure that threat happens by the aggressive tone in the region, now positioning missile bases on Taiwan, upping the ante with trade, all the rest of it, quasi-diplomatic relations with some of their allies, including Australia, with Taiwan, doing everything within their power to stir the pot. And whenever China respond to an exercise like this, it becomes further proof that China are a threat and therefore have to be responded to, stood up to, as Dutton would say. Exactly the same scenario really happening on the other hemisphere, where we keep on pushing, Russia responds in some kind, just in words rather than deeds, as both sides have been doing. Therefore, that proves there is a threat. Therefore, we have to counter the threat. So the Taiwan thing is particularly, I mean, dangerous for us because it's close to us, but the two are linked so closely. And the policy of the United States is unashamedly militaristic in their foreign policy capacities. A lot of countries frame foreign policy through economic requirements, political requirements, and so on. The United States, because it was formed in the heyday of imperialist power, where countries took what they needed or thought they needed, America came into being during that period. And so it is really deeply entrenched in its psyche that you frame foreign policy with three prongs to the spear, to the trident: economic, political, and military. The military becomes an expression of foreign policy. The last century, sadly, has shown that to be very much the case. So the Taiwan and Ukraine thing, I think, are, as you say, so much in parallel, so much in common, and so horribly transparent on their part.
And I guess, just to sort of conclude the interview, wondering whether you have any final comments, William, or any sort of predictions, I guess, for how this will pan out.
Predictions. I'll cast my eye over the crystal ball. Predictions I try to avoid, but to go to the Ukraine first, my prediction would be that some sort of status quo will maintain. Russia, I don't believe, are crazy enough to attempt an invasion. There wouldn't be any troops on the ground in the United States, but the Russian economy would be absolutely shattered. I don't think anything particular will happen there. There'd be a lot of huff, a lot of puff, and some way along the way, Facebook's attempt to be found. It's not going to go away, though, because the United States still have the economic imperative of weakening Russia. With China and Taiwan, that is possibly more problematic because China, having now made such proclamations that we will take Taiwan if necessary. What happens when you get to a stage where push does come to shove? I don't know. I hope it doesn't. And I hope that progressive forces around the world, including here, can build the alliance required to make governments, make states unable to act with impunity as we have for so many, many decades. That, I think, might be a big ask, but it's something that we've all got to struggle for.
Mm. Well, yeah, thank you very much for that, William. I think this has been a very kind of informative kind of interview, and I think a very good kind of discussion, especially going through, I guess, all the kind of complexities of this whole kind of conflict. So, yeah, I'd like to thank you very much, William, for being on our program. And
an absolute pleasure.
Okay. All right. So we're just interviewing William Briggs, who is a political economist, and also just want to make a plug recently. He's also an author and has actually recently authored a book, which we might actually get him to speak about at some point, which is titled China, the USA and Capitalism's Last Crusade. But at the same time, he's also been a regular writer for Green Left and, yeah, has produced articles to the effect around the US, around the US's role in the Russian-Ukraine conflict, but then also talking about the US's policy around Taiwan. Okay, I might just go, I'll play a quick announcement. You are listening to Green Left Radio.
Goongroo Environment Centre is a grassroots community organisation.